Start this evening reading a poem. It's kind of an odd poem, and either it doesn't read well, or more likely I can't read as well. But it kind of hinges on the last word, and which kind of struck me when I first time I read it. So if you'll bear along. It's called Lightning Bugs, and it's by August Kleinstaller. Lightning Bugs. The cruel world at eventide. The night sips up like a spider's retreat. Go back to your needlework. We shall not be chasing lightning bugs in the tall grass tonight. Put the whiskey on the shelf and let us speak calmly of money. And why did you laugh? If it said calmly of love or nature, and you see, people would have said, "Oh yes," but somehow money in our consciousness, the way we think, kind of seems kind of odd in that kind of context. The way it's kind of flowing along nicely, and for many of us, at least, there's certainly for me when I first time I read it, and so I came home last night from teaching retreat. A wonderful 9-day retreat up in Vajrapani, Boulder Creek, and some of you were there. And it felt like a very nice retreat. It felt fairly profound for people. And it was very hot. But the teachers were saying, I think the heat actually, the meditative students kind of didn't maybe realize it so much, but it seemed like the heat actually helped. Because it seemed like kind of you couldn't go anywhere. It's kind of like people were more grounded or in their body, solid with all this heat kind of all over everywhere. But I don't know if it's true, but it was very solid. It felt like a relatively solid retreat. Very nice. So I came back from kind of inspired and very happy to be there. It's a wonderful spiritual activity. And on my message machine, the phone, was a call from an editor from Tricycle. Saying that he'd heard that I'd written an article about money for the Inquiring Mind, and that they're doing an issue on money, and if they could use it, or if I could write something about money. And I hadn't written an article about money. And he called me again. So there was a message, and so he called me again today, and he asked me, and I said, no, I hadn't written anything on money. And I had written a small little 2-paragraph thing on generosity. that was meant for a fundraising report for the San Francisco Zen Center. I wrote a couple of years ago, but never ended up being used. And I thought maybe the first paragraph you could use as a little pull quote or something. And he asked me to send it to him. So I've been thinking about money today, so that's what I thought I'd talk a little bit about money. I don't have anything profound to say, so I feel a little bit odd to sit down and take that as a subject. But I think it's a very useful subject for us to look at for many reasons. Now, first, I'm aware that some of us who kind of were part of the, aging hippie culture or whatever. In the 60s and 70s, there was a kind of, among many people, a kind of strong anti-money feeling, that money was somehow evil in and of itself or wrong, and you shouldn't have money, you shouldn't have a lot of money, you should be poor, you should be hitchhiking around and barefoot and having a great time. Which many of us did. I spent, it was 1974. I spent 6 months traveling around the country, hitchhiking, wonderful time, on $100. And I was quite comfortable with that, no problems. So there's this kind of anti-money feeling that kind of circulates in our culture, and I don't know exactly where the beginning of it is. Some of it was, the 60s perhaps, but they got it from somewhere, I'm sure. And some of it's a reaction, I think, against some of the ways money is used and the attitudes people have towards money in our culture, which sometimes is full of greed and ambition and status and showing off. And so there's a reaction against kind of the misuse of money, or funny ways or unwholesome ways the money is used. But, you know, some of it, that's one root, perhaps, and some of it comes back maybe to our Judeo-Christian roots also. And you find Jesus, some passages in Jesus where he's very critical of money and wealth. And he has this famous passage where he says it's harder for a wealthy man to enter into heaven than it's as hard as a wealthy person to enter into heaven as it is for a camel to go through, pass through the eye of a needle. And other kind of quotes like that around wealth and money. And then there's this ideal of poverty that then you find in Christianity and in our culture. And this is, you know, there's also poverty has a certain ideal. Living in the life of poverty has a lot of value religiously in the Western consciousness. So then some of these, you know, hippies, aging hippies, they weren't aging then, but... But they were, but they didn't know it. went to practice Buddhism in Asia or here in this country. And we went to practice in Asia especially. We tended to go practice in the monasteries there. And the monks, the nuns in the monasteries, tended to live a life of simplicity that looked like, and you know, we called them monks, it's a monastic life, which was not a Buddhist word. I mean, that's a Christian word, right? So you have to be a little bit careful when you take a Christian word and say, you know, you and apply it to another whole culture and say, I found it there. And so perhaps we should be maybe a little sensitive. The word monk and monastic maybe doesn't apply for Buddhism, and maybe we need to kind of look at it from a little bit different angle. But anyway, the ideal in the West of being a monk is an ideal of poverty, the vows of poverty. And so you go and you study, but the monks and nuns in Asia are not supposed to handle money. And they're not supposed to have a lot of possessions. And they're not supposed to have food, for example, after 12 o'clock. At 12 o'clock, they have to forfeit all food. And the next day, they have to, whatever food comes their way before noon, they can eat, and then they forfeit it. So not handling money, not having a lot of possessions, the attitude towards money, towards food, looks like they're living lives of poverty. Looks like it lends itself for us with our Western ideas about money to, oh, to kind of supports the idea money is bad perhaps and we shouldn't have money and we should live a life of poverty. But I think that we're kind of, many Buddhists, they kind of impose onto Buddhism Western ideas of money and wealth. And so we still find very strongly, I believe, in Euro-American-based Buddhism in the West, Western ideas about poverty and wealth and certain kind of uncomfortability with money and wealth in a way that is not the way that money was understood by the Buddha in the early Buddhist tradition. And so it comes a little bit as a strange thing to hear this for many Westerners who are studying Buddhism, that money, the Buddha in many times actually found value in money. Money had value, importance. There was nothing inherently wrong with having money and wealth. And there was no particular ideal of poverty. Poverty in and of itself was considered to be an unfortunate status to have that creates a lot of suffering for people. And the hope was that people wouldn't be poor and that you'd alleviate the conditions for poverty. And the ideal of a monastic, the simplicity of a monk, wasn't necessarily a vow of poverty. The ideal in Buddhism is not poverty. The ideal in Buddhism is contentment, and fewness of desires, having few desires and being content. That's more the ideal than poverty. And how contentment and fewness of desires expresses itself in your life might vary, but it doesn't necessarily have to be meaning that you're poor. And the monk, the monastic life, is not an ideal for everybody. It's not like an ideal life, in a sense. It's not like an ideal life, like this is the way everybody should be living in order to follow the religious ideal. The monastic life is a pragmatic strategy. that strategically it's very useful to live this way, not to handle money, not to have food after 12 o'clock. It's an ideal of simplicity. It's a strategy of simplicity, and it's a strategy of looking to being confronted with issues around we have with money and food and possessions, issues like ambition and greed and fear and insecurity. So all these things are kind of, you know, you're kind of confronted with to face and deal with, not because you're supposed to be poor, but because the goal is to live a life where the heart is free and not clinging in any kind of way. And one of the places people cling a lot is around money and their possessions. And so so the strategy of monastic life is to look at that by not participating in fully in the simple life. But it's not an ideal of poverty. And the monks, you know, hopefully have lived well and fed well and have lots of medicine and have lots of clothes, you know, have enough robes. They have what they need to live. So the Buddhist tradition then distinguishes between the suffering that arises from not getting what you need versus the suffering that comes from not getting what you want. And those two are two different things. And the monastics are supposed to, hopefully, depending on if the laity support them, hopefully the monks have, you know, a comfortable life. Though some of us wouldn't believe that. Maybe for some of us it looks kind of ascetic. But the Buddha was suggesting a middle path, middle way he called it, between asceticism and indulgence. And for monastics, he defined it a certain way. But for laity, they find that in a little different lifestyle. But still, it's the middle way between those two. So the monastics are supposed to have, you know, their basic needs satisfied quite well. So they can devote themselves to their practice and being of service and teaching and whatever they do. What the Buddha criticized was concerned about was not wealth and money in and of itself, which is kind of a neutral phenomena, but the ways in which it's acquired and the ways in which it's used. And money which is lawfully and morally acquired, the Buddha said it's fine. It's actually considered, for a lay person, the Buddha said it was an appropriate goal to acquire money and even become wealthy. Now that resonates kind of a little bit funny among some of us aging hippies. I don't know, you know, all of you. And it's complicated because we have there is very sophisticated analysis of how the economy runs in our culture and in our world and how money is acquired and how it circulates. And so money has a lot of deleterious effects the way it's used. And so a lot of people say, well, let's not be involved in it. But in and of itself, money in the Buddhist tradition is understood as being somewhat neutral. In and of itself, it has no value in and of itself. It has no inherent value in and of itself. It has value from what it's associated with, how it's acquired, and what it can be and how it is used. So that's what the Buddha was concerned about, those issues. So certainly money had to be acquired lawfully and morally. And the first three precepts in particular are very important for understanding how appropriate ways of acquiring money or wealth. It should not involve killing, it should not involve stealing, and perhaps the most difficult of all for many of us is it should not involve lying. Because I think there's a lot of lying that goes on in various professions. It might be very subtle. It's just kind of, is advertisement truth? It's not exactly lying, is it always? But is it right speech? So the whole area of right speech. So understanding, looking at one's livelihood and how one acquires money, and is anybody hurt in the process? If no one's hurt in the process of the way you acquire money, the Buddha said it's fine to become wealthy, quite wealthy, and he was quite happy to be supportive of very wealthy people. But then how you use the money. The Buddha was very critical of people who just kept all their money hidden away and never used it. He said that was really stupid. Because, you know, if you never use your money, never do anything with it, it's like, the analogy he used was, it's like there's this beautiful lake of clear water in the middle of some isolated desert where no one ever lives or no one ever goes, it doesn't have any value for anybody. That lake is a lot better if it was kind of next to a village where there was farms and people could use the water for their farming or whatever. It's kind of empty. It has no value. The value comes from the use of money. And money is just a piece of paper, a piece of plastic nowadays for us in credit cards. And how it's acquired, it has symbolic value for many of us. It represents a lot for us. And so, for example, money represents what it represents comes partly from what we can get from it. So it represents, for example, for some people, status. For some people, it represents security. For some people, it represents pleasure and joy. Because you can do happy things with money. You can make yourself happy a little bit. The Buddha said there's two worldly ways that are considered wholesome to be happy. One is to spend your money in ways that make you happy. I mean, for pleasure. I mean, not for, but I mean, spend your money and, go to a movie or, do nice things with money that kind of brings happiness and pleasure. That's considered to be a nice thing to do by the Buddha. The other way, worldly way of being happy, is to do virtuous deeds, to live a moral and upright life and to do virtuous things, to be generous and kind and helpful to the world. And that brings happiness. So money represents stuff. And it's interesting for me that I think there's sometimes you hear this attitude that, I paid for it after all. That if it's my money, then it's mine, or I have certain rights to it. And the whole notion of me and mine is a study that Buddhists make to understand very well the suffering that arises out of our acquisitiveness, our possessiveness. When we hold really tightly to something that is mine, it tends to lead to suffering. And if that sense of mine, possessive, comes from our money, then money becomes symbolic of a sense of ourselves. And the tremendous pain that some people feel when they lose all their money. I mean, not all their money, but what happens when the stock market crashes? How many of you check the stock market, to see if the Dow Jones goes up and down? And when it goes down, well, I don't know, 20 points? Is that enough to kind of go... Is that what it takes? Or is it 70 points? you're living quite a nice life. You have a job, you have a house, and things are going along quite nicely. And 70 points, it's depressing. If it went down, 500 points, people are jumping out of windows. What does it represent? Why? I mean, I don't have any answers to these things, but money is very representative of something in our culture. And to understand and begin thinking about what it represents for us. I was very struck when I was growing up a little bit in Norway. My grandfather had... went traveling to Germany. I guess it was the Nazi Germany, the late 20s or early 30s. And the inflation was phenomenal. And so they had to, rather than reissuing money all the time, they took their bills and they just stamped a higher denomination on top of it. And so he had this bill, it was basically, he told me it's basically worth toilet paper back then. And it had something like 10 million stamped across it. I think originally it was like, I don't know what it was, 100 marks. And then it was stamped, 10 million marks across the top because inflation was so rapid. And I was in Brazil some years ago and when inflation there was very high. And people didn't want to use money. They didn't want to touch money. Everybody wanted to use checks. Because their money in the bank automatically adjusted for inflation. And as soon as you took the cash out, you weren't adjusted anymore. So you didn't want to touch the money because, in 2 days, its inflation was 30%. So everybody paid by checks as much as they could. And then when I was in Burma, I think I've told the story, I went and changed my good American greenback money. Which American money is worth a lot. It's the very stable, secure money, and you can trust it always. And much of the world trusts American green money. And so I took my green money and I changed it for this thing called kyats, which is what their denomination is. And I changed it to certain amounts I'd have when I was on retreat for any needs I had. And when you retreat, you know, in silence for all these months, you can't go to the bank, you can't leave the monastery, and you have to rely so on this money you have. Well, the government decided from one evening to the next morning that all the denominations above a dollar were worthless. How could that happen? I mean, money is, you know, you can trust it, right? I mean, that's something you could trust, like anything else. I was just flabbergasted. So the money I had, you know, I woke up in the morning, it was paper, it was toilet paper. What does it represent for us, money? So it's interesting, people ask me sometimes, well, on the retreat we were teaching, there was, it's kind of tight quarters there a little bit. So there's a dining room and kind of picnic tables outside. And in the middle of this complex, the dining room and the picnic tables where the yogis, the meditators are eating, is the staff room, this little office, tight little office, where the three teachers and the three staff hang out and eat their meals. And we're not, you know, exactly on retreats in the same way. So we're talking kind of, you know, we think it's kind of quiet and and mindful and stuff and whatever. And we got a note in the middle of the retreat saying, I think that you in there, I think you guys need a mindfulness bell. Because the sound coming out of there, I guess, was a little bit... occasionally, perhaps. But people, mindfulness bells, you know, little bells, something reminds us to be mindful. And I've used going through doorways as being a mindfulness reminder. Every time I go through a doorway, I'm going into a new space, so I'll take that to check in. What's going on? Be reminded myself to wake up, as opposed to being lost in my fantasies and my ideas and thoughts and worries and whatever. So I propose a mindfulness signal, and that is every time you spend money. Every time you spend money, that's a time to wake up and pay attention, and to find out how do you feel, what's going on with you. And that can roll into a whole bunch of interesting study. What is your attitude to what you're doing right now? Do you need what you're doing? Money is an interesting place to measure where our priorities are. Because we can say our priorities are X, but if you study where your money goes, it might be Y. So to study, you know, where does the flow of money go? What is it connecting to? What is it supporting? What is your attitude about your money that you're giving? Are you giving it reluctantly or angrily or resentfully or with resistance? Or are you giving it with some generosity, with some joy? Sometimes I don't like to be overcharged for things. But sometimes I don't mind, because there are times when the people who are overcharging me, I know that they don't have a very good life. They're not making much money. And I know that I could go somewhere else and make a little bit, get a better deal I know that they're kind of like in Asia sometimes, or someplace they see an American and they jack the price up. They double the price, you know. And I remember the first time of this or triple the price or 10 times the price or whatever. You know, I was in Morocco when I was young, and when I was 18 and 19, and I asked this guy, we had befriended this guy who sold rugs on the side of the road. This young guy was about our age. And he explained to me his policy, how he decided how much to charge. And he said, depending on what country they came from. And so like Italians, it was twice the price. And Germans, it was four times. But Americans was 10 times. But you know, these people are just struggling. They hardly make, you know. So when people overcharge, I said, actually, it's fine with me. It's kind of nice to support them and help them out a little bit. And I feel even more now, because my livelihood now comes almost entirely from people donating money to me, this Donna basket and all that. So I'm kind of in the system where it's kind of like, if you know, I'm receiving people's generosity, I feel even really more inspired now to kind of pass it on, be generous to other people for services they do, and give people, you know, It's called a tip in our culture, but, you know, be generous and help people out. The movement of generosity, understand where our money goes. So a feeling of generosity we give, we pay for something that, you know, it's actually, it can be an act of generosity. Someone's being supported. Many people are being supported by this little act, rather than, you know, all me and mine is being lost. I have this image, you know, that money represents a flow of something in our culture, a flow of energy, a flow of intention, a flow of priorities, a flow of support. And it kind of this, it flows around, maybe like a whirlpool, or maybe it's, I don't know how it flows. But when it passes through me, I put a certain spin on that flow. And that spins out a little bit. And maybe it goes, I don't know, you know, maybe it's like, you know, an eddy in the water, and it kind of goes for a little while, and then it kind of dissolves in the wider stream. But at least I put a little spin on it for a little while. So, for example, you know, if I buy cigarettes, that puts a certain spin on that money, I believe. And that supports people who do other kinds of things. And, you know, it maybe supports the cigarette companies to do more advertisement, and, you know, and advertising, and put more advertisements for kids to get them to smoke, or advertisements for all these women in China who don't smoke, but it's the next big, greatest market in the world is Chinese women. So let's bombard them with all these images of America and how wonderful it is for women to smoke. And so when I buy my cigarettes, you know, I put that spin on that money. If I go to the local supermarket, like Safeway, there's a certain spin in the money. That's different little spin if I go to a local kind of corner store. And sometimes the corner store might be a little more expensive, but it's a different spin. And if you think about the spin, then maybe it affects your priorities. You know, is your priority simply to keep as much money in your own tight little world as possible and not kind of let it go? Or is the purpose of your life to create nice spins? So think, you know, how is this money being spent? You know, what are you doing with it? I'm kind of fond that when I studied for a while with Eiken Roshi, a Zen teacher in Hawaii. And when you go to study with him, it's a little bit of a Zen formal kind of system. You have to ask him to become your teacher. And you do it with a little slight ritual that you have to go into the interview room and do your bows. And you have to give him a gift, as an expression of your respect, your honoring him, and your sincerity and all that. And I thought it was a little bit odd because the gift had to be money. And it was slightly funny to me, you know, money, but it was only $3. the ritual was very specific, $3. But what was more interesting to me was it had to be brand new crisp dollar bills. Because that somehow, the newness and the cleanliness or whatever, the money, that actually was in some ways an expression also of the respect that was happening in that. It was a transaction. Something was happening there. And having these new crisp dollars as opposed to these crumpled up, you know, half torn and stained, you know, it smells like they've been in someone's butt for, you know, the last 2 months. You know, there's, you know, money has a different feel to it. So it was an expression of something to have. You had to go to the bank and ask for these crisp dollar bills and put it in a nice little envelope. So what do we express in our money is the question. The Buddha... I'll say one more thing here. How to acquire money. So the Buddha said various things about that, but there's a beautiful poem where he talks, gives kind of a model or an analogy for how to acquire money. So the poem goes like this. The wise who are trained and disciplined shine out like beacon lights. They earn money just as a bee gathers honey without harming the flowers. And they let it grow as an anthill slowly gains in height. With wealth wisely gained, they use it for the benefit of all. And I love that image of, you know, a bee gathering honey doesn't disturb the flower at all. So to gather wealth, to gather your money in a way that doesn't harm anything around you, it just, you know, and just gathering it, you know, like a hunt, like a bee, and let it grow like an anthill. I suppose that means let it grow slowly, I suppose. But also anthill, I guess, is stable. So let it grow some stability. So the Buddha suggested various things, but one thing he said was about spending your money. One way, there's four areas, four. You should divide up your money in four parts, he said. One was, one fourth you should spend on yourself for your requisites and needs. Two-fourths of it, half of it, you should reinvest into your business. If you have a business, it's appropriate, I guess. I don't know how we... And the last fourth, now I forget. But I think the last quarter must be for the giveaway to others, support other people. And this idea of generosity, of giving, is really central to the Buddhist tradition, to be generous. It's the first spiritual practice, actually, we're supposed to practice. Buddha offered a gradual training in spiritual life. And for him, the spiritual life begins with developing generosity. Not so much because generosity is a good thing for society and other people, which it is, but it's good for your own spiritual inner life to be generous. You do it for almost for yourself. What it takes to be generous in a genuine way requires a kind of open-heartedness, a kind of letting go of acquisitiveness, of greed, of ambition, of holding things tight, of me and mine. It requires an openness of connectedness to other people, a sensitivity to other people. And all those are necessary qualities for the development of a spiritual life. And the Buddha started with generosity because without the development of those strong qualities, it's actually very hard to go on and continue with the other points in the spiritual life. And I've been thinking a little bit recently about how the idea of understanding no self, selflessness in Buddhism, goes together with a training that develops qualities of being which in the Western parlance is considered to belong to a very strong self. Though there's no self in Buddhism, but we have these qualities become very strong. Strong qualities of honesty, of energy, quality of effort, quality of paying attention, qualities of love, qualities of generosity. So generosity is one. There's a beautiful Zen koan, or story, where someone comes to a Zen master, Wei Hai, and says, "What is the gate of Zen? What's the gate?" And Wei Hai says, "Complete giving." And I think it's a beautiful answer. You know, he didn't say enlightenment, or he didn't say, what's the gate of Zen? But what I love about this is that the word gate, you can both, it's a place where you enter and you exit. So what's the entrance and the exit from Zen? It's generosity. What's the beginning and end of Buddhism, a Buddhist practice? It's generosity. And whether you think it's the beginning practice or the culmination of your spirituality, it's the same, it's generosity. So having money allows a person to be generous. One of the values of acquiring money is it gives you the opportunity to be generous. Gives you the opportunity to participate in the spin. And you participate by how you acquire. Living simply is also one way of creating spins and not having a lot of money. Remember, contentment and fewness of wishes is a primary virtue. Generosity is a primary virtue.
Y'all?
Yes?
I wanted to say something about the rich man and the eye of the needle.
Yes.
I'm not a biblical scholar. But I've heard that what that's talking, actually the way it's translated is, it's as hard for a rich man with his wealth to enter the kingdom of heaven as it is for his camel to go through the eye of the needle. The eye of the needle was a real place.
Oh.
And in order to pass through that pass, the baggage had to be taken off the camel.
Oh, I see.
So it's harder for rich people to go through attached to their luggage.
Beautiful, beautiful.
Right?
Beautiful.
As it is for people to go to heaven attached. No,
that's beautiful.
To their wealth. That's really what it was about.
Maybe. There's a lot of things which you understand the context, they have a different meaning than the way they've often been interpreted. And it's often been interpreted in the history of Christianity as being very critical of wealth, but not always. But beautiful. I think it's a really appropriate way of understanding it. And so this thing, the whole thing about clinging is really also kli. What are you holding on to? So how do you hold your wealth? You hold your wealth generously with, or you hold it really tight to yourself, and you know, like a miser. Being a miser is considered to be one of the terrible sufferings in Buddhism. And then the last thing I'll say is, I read a poem here some months ago, and the beautiful image of the poem was something like, you know, if you're holding a little bird in your hand, and you hold it really tight, it's not a bird. But if you hold it loosely and let it fly, it becomes a bird. Some things are not really things, not really what they're meant to be, if you hold them too tightly. So what else do you have to say about money? Thank you. What else, anybody? You know, we're uncomfortable with it, we're afraid of it, we want more of it, we're insecure about it. Yes?
I've been thinking during this evening that why it has a feeling in America especially, although maybe it's the same in the rest of the world, I don't know, but money in this country is power. And power to me usually seems to operate when there's fear and inner instability. And money has become attached to all of that. Both of my grandfathers committed suicide during the Depression. Both of them. And they lost parts of their fortunes.
Parts.
Not the entire thing, but a great deal of it.
Yeah.
And my parents would say, oh, that was just the Depression. Which didn't seem to eliminate things very much, but I think it is somehow connected to power, and I think that's one reason that the young people of the 60s and 70s
yes.
did not want to be connected to that kind of strangling
yeah.
power.
Yeah, I think very much so. The way it was being used in our culture was very dangerous.
Probably it's used that way everywhere. I don't know, but certainly in our culture it's felt very oppressively.
Yeah. So it takes a lot to study. So the moment of mindfulness when you use money is not just, you know, what's going on in that moment itself, but it's what we're connected to, what we're connected to when we use the money. Karl Marx said something beautiful, my thoughts, about money. He said, money can either unite us or separate us. And so what's our choice? When we use it, are we using it to separate us or connect us with others? And power separates us. And I thought of the same thing today, because on the radio today or yesterday, they talked about all the how money's being used at the party conventions. And that's exactly what they said, that the money's being used as access to power. Yes.
Remembering the quote I read somewhere this week, I think it goes, money is congealed energy.
So we need something to dissolve the clot.
I was just going to ask if you're going to write the book, I would make a nice article.
I won't. I'm not going to write it up, but if someone transcribes this, then I might work on it.
Well, I thought an explanation of for the Depression was that there wasn't a shortage of money, but people became so frightened they wouldn't spend it, and that stopped.
The average American household has a credit card debt of $5,000. American family. That's what the paper said last week. Paper, I don't know. Paper. They're spending it. Yes?
I wonder if anyone knows when money got started.
Money. It existed in the time of the Buddha. It existed at the time of the Buddha, so it predated it. You know, I don't know how old it goes back. It's an interesting question. I'm sure there's books on anthropology. There's a very nice book to be read, I recommend, called The Gift. Actually, several books with the same title, but the one that's published not by Moose. It's a book that was published first in the 1920s, but this was published in late 70s. It's called The Gift. And it's a beautiful, the first half of it is a beautiful discussion about gifts and generosity and money. And it talks about different anthropological studies in different parts of the world and what money and gift giving means in our culture and how it flows. And I really recommend it if you're interested in the subject. The subtitle is called The Erotic Life of Money? No. The Erotic Life of... Anyway, it's a beautiful book. I haven't read it. But I think it's well worth. I've thought for some time to give a talk about money, but I thought, well, I better spend a lot of time studying and learning something about it, and either reading those books, and because I feel like it's really a juicy subject. There's a lot going on in money, because money is just a piece of paper. It definitely more is going on than a piece of paper. But anyway, because of this phone call yesterday, I just blabbed away. Yes?
You know, it might be helpful sometimes to give a lecture on right livelihood as it affects money.
Okay. Great.
Yeah. I was just thinking, I thought that idea of the spin was very interesting, or an interesting way to stop and think about spending money. And I was also thinking about feeling on the other end of a spin.
Yes.
In regards to that, it's just the recipient of generosity, and a friend wanted to, insisted upon helping pay for part of the retreat. And I struggled on that other end of that. It didn't really, I was very appreciative of the offer, didn't want to accept it. But she really talked about it a long time. She told me how much would really please her. I need this practice to learn how to receive it. And so I did accept it, and it's been really interesting to be on that end, and I really do feel some larger thing happening.
Beautiful. Beautiful. I think that's beautiful. Learning to receive is as important as learning to give, and if we value giving, and we can't receive, we're not. It's not very nice. And we're always on the receiving end of a spin, no matter what. But there's different spins we receive. But that's one. I feel it all the time. I'm on the receiving end of the spin of all the people who give me dana. And that affects me deeply. I'm in that kind of spin. I'm kind of spinning in that. I'm spinning away. it's a powerful spin to have my livelihood come from that kind of strange, un-American kind of way of living a life, and it really deeply affects me. And deeply appreciative. And I hope then I really want to keep spinning things in that direction. Keep spinning with those kind of values. I want to live my life that way. And I consider how I use the money that I get because of the way I've gotten it. Last one. Yes?
Yeah. I was in a group last night, and a speaker made this quote, and it's so good, it's a shame not to share it with you, and it relates to what you've been talking about. It went this way, this is about three sentences. If you want to be happy for an hour, take a nap. If you want to be happy for a day, go fishing. If you want to be happy for a month, get married. If you want to be happy for a year, inherit some money. If you want to be happy for life, do something for others. it's an anonymous
beautiful. And it said, you know, one of the practices of Buddhism is to reflect and enjoy and celebrate our good deeds. And so doing something for others is a good deed, and you carry that with you for your life to make you happy. So thank you very much.